we each relate to those things like Jesus Christ or the Lord Buddha or Krishna or Shiva or Mohammed or whoever. We each can have our own kind of particular reaction, interest or lack of interest in these as we hear about them. We're not all going to feel exactly the same way. And so, say, in many ways, I remember growing up in the United States thinking that there was some kind of normal human being, because they talked about normality as if everybody knew what that was. There's a normal way to be for a man and a woman. And you could talk about being normal as if, and you assumed that your mother and father, everybody knew what they were talking about. But you had this fear that somehow you didn't quite fit into that category. Of course, you didn't want to tell anyone, and you pretended you were as normal like everyone else was pretending. But it became apparent that nobody really knew what it meant. It was another one of those things, those ideas that nobody ever contemplates. They just say, you know, what's normal human behavior? And we say, well, of course I do. Yes. Knowing very well, you don't know what the heck that means. Or maybe it's just some kind of assumed attitude that you have is a kind of a white middle-class American that might not fit into what's normal for a middle-class British person. But then you assume that normality is something that applies to everyone, whether it's European or Asian, African. But what is it? And what is, when we say a normal person, and what is an abnormal person? So contemplating these things, we begin to recognize that the more you experience life, the more you realize that the world, that the planet Earth is populated with an infinite variety of individual human beings who maybe each one are perfect in their own way. You can contemplate like this. Rather than thinking that amid this 5 billion 0.4 population of planet Earth, there might be a few significant creatures you might call normal or perfect, but you probably won't come across them in your lifetime. Or you hear about them. This is very common amongst the Western Buddhist world. You hear about somebody who's become enlightened and immediately you rush off to check them out. But when you go look at somebody who's supposed to be enlightened, they just look like some ordinary person. They don't look like they're enlightened. Or maybe they do things that you think an enlightened person wouldn't do. So that they stare at the ceiling, or they smoke cigarettes, or they chew tobacco, or something that you think an enlightened person would never do. So then we get into all kinds of confusion, because some people claim to be enlightened and they do very outrageous things. We think that may be the sign of enlightenment, is you're outrageous. You do all the things no one else dares do. You say all the things that no one And there's a certain part of us that likes that, the idea of being able to kind of thumb your nose at the establishment, the kind of heavy established order of life that says this is right and this is how you should be, and something in us wants to kind of rebel against that, because we can see that that sometimes human society settles for mediocrity as normal. What's normal and what's safe is a kind of low-level mediocrity. This is what oftentimes happens in democratic systems, isn't it? Where we, or socialistic systems and that, where you kind of settle for a drabness of human behavior, controlled, and where nobody is doing anything that's too upsetting or too threatening. Or if they are, they're severely reprimanded or punished or exiled or murdered or exterminated. So what is a perfect human being? And then we can create an ideal of a perfect human being, which is, we can figure all the best, say, proportions of the human body for the female or the male, or the most beautiful features, and then the ideal of being very intelligent, a certain level of IQ, and having a certain benevolence and compassion, sense of humor, all that. We can put all the superlatives together of what would be the best and create a kind of ideal of perfection. But I'm not talking about perfection as an ideal, as just the superlatives that we can imagine, but the reality of perfection. Because each one of us, say, is living our lives. What is the reason for it? What is it that we have to learn from it? So this is what we contemplate. And we can go to teachers and try to find out what they think we should do. Tell me, what is the meaning of life, and why am I here, and how should I live my life? Because we do like to hear what other people say, or what people that we think have contemplated this or come to some understanding of the human condition. But yet, no matter how wise their suggestions might be, and how knowledgeable and how enlightened and perfect they might be in themselves, it doesn't really do us that much good till we learn to develop in our own life, within ourselves, within our own mind. Because we can absorb, we can take into consideration what other people say, what institutions say, what the scriptures say, what the authorities say, what the outrageous members of the society say. But in the long run, we're left with, this is the way it is. This is the way we feel. These are the kind of tendencies we find ourselves inclined to. This is what we're attracted to or repelled by. This is how we emotionally feel when somebody says this or somebody doesn't say something. But it's something that we can contemplate, no matter what it is. Because we're in that position of awakening to the way it is. So when we talk like words like this, and the way it is, the suchness, as isness, then these are words that don't describe anything. They can't. This is the way it is. What does he mean by that? But it's pointing to, inviting us, it's an invitation, encouragement, to contemplate. What is the way it is right now? Not that it has to be any way, it doesn't matter how anyone else sees the way it is. This is actually how I'm feeling right now. This is the whether it's physical or emotional feeling. But there is that ability to contemplate it, to witness it, to meditate upon it. (Clears throat) Now, in this human realm, the experience is one of the basic experience that we all have is the experience of consciousness that comes from being born into this form. So consciousness what is it? I mean, it's a common enough word. And we could give definitions from the dictionary on how you define it. But as an experience, consciousness is this way. We're all conscious right now. And so this is the experience of consciousness. In Pali we call it vijnana, which means that we can, we're here, and there's this experience of knowing things, of being a subject, and that is being impinged on in some way, that is feeling something, that is thinking something. So consciousness is just this way. We can see it when a baby is born. A baby is born, it's a separate conscious being. Where before it was, its consciousness was its mother's consciousness. So it wasn't separate yet, it was connected. It was experiencing the sensitive state through the mother. And then when we're born, say, then the umbilical cord is severed, then we're experiencing consciousness as in a seemingly separate way. We're no longer experiencing it through our mothers, but through this form. And so that a baby, say, is a fully conscious individual being. So this is a contemplation of consciousness. We see all that life is consciousness itself. The animal kingdom is conscious. People say even the plants are conscious. The trees are conscious. You think, what do they, they don't look so, they aren't conscious like I am. They don't have eyes. But they have a form, don't they? They feel things. They're not just lumps of inert plastic that somehow just were dumped here on the planet. They have what is the magic? What is the formula that makes them grow from an oak, from an acorn, and all that? So we recognize that we're experiencing a kind of what for us seems like a mystery or a miracle. Something comes out of nothing in our own human perspective. And just the human birth, what is it? An egg and a sperm come together. 60 years later, this is and yet we can think, look at an egg and a sperm, doesn't look like much of anything. It is like protoplasm. It doesn't have any personality. It doesn't have anything other than it's just some kind of matter, really, with something in it that makes it do these things. But yet, when those two forces unite and something takes place, and then as the child is born, then maybe we're starting our lives, say, as a separate human entity, an individual being. So we contemplate this for a whole life. We have to live like this as a separate, in a separate form. So this is consciousness, and this conscious experience means that we, wherever we are on this planet, whether we're sitting here at Amaravati on the 28th of August 1994, listening to Ajahn Sumedho, or whether we're in Thailand or in India or Rwanda or the Amazon jungle or wherever, that we are, this is where we are, and we're experiencing, we're feeling whatever is happening, good or bad, pleasant or painful. Now, how we interpret it is another thing, isn't it? Like if we say, if we have a certain culture, then we tend to see things in a certain way. We see when we start becoming, like, as a child grows up, then it's influenced by its culture, by its parents, its peers, the grandparents, the society around it, kind of informs it, tells it what life is about, what is, boys are, girls are, what duties are, what we're supposed to be. So we acquire all kinds of perceptions about life in ourselves. And so we see things from certain positions. It's interesting living in different cultures. For example, in Thailand, I remember it's the idea of sitting, pointing your feet at a Buddha Rupa upsets the Thai people. Because that in their culture, you never point your feet at a Buddha Rupa, a Buddha image. So when any of us who lived in Thailand didn't know that at first, we point our feet at the Buddha Rupa and everybody's looking very disgusted with us. We don't know why. Because that's not a part of our cultural conditioning. My mommy never told me that. She didn't even mention Buddha Rupas. But yet in a Buddhist country, that would be like contempt, or pointing your feet at somebody is like showing contempt. When you want to show contempt to somebody and kind of, you know, look down on them and treat them contemptuously, you point your feet at them. So, I mean, that's a cultural thing. That's not universal truth, but that's a cultural practice that is picked up. It's probably hardly even mentioned. It's just a part of a whole acculturation. And so, you know, myself and Ajahn Damo, I'm sure our time in Thailand, we picked it up so that to this day I see somebody sitting with their feet pointing at a Buddha Rupa, I go into this, have the same reaction. I go like that. Why is that? Because I wasn't acculturated as a baby, but I certainly lived a decade of my life in Thailand where one was very much influenced by those kind of cultural attitudes. And yet it's oftentimes these things that are the causes of wars and angst of all kinds, isn't it? Just the cultural differences and attitudes that just are not based on universal truth, but just cultural emphasis. So we acquire a way of interpreting life from our cultural background, ethnic background, and that determines how we interpret, how we see ourselves, and how we interpret our experience. Now, say the conventions that that we call Buddhism or the Buddha Dhamma. These are, say, for many of us who have adopted, who've become Buddhists, we weren't born into Buddhist families, but we chose Buddhism, we chose the Buddha Dhamma as a something that we wanted to follow. So this means that we're learning how to, say, use the Buddhist teachings for what? To become Buddhists in terms of just becoming acculturated, kind of adopting Buddhist attitudes, Buddhist costumes, Buddhist practices, Buddhist ceremonies, and become Buddhists through the external, through the believing in the teachings and reading the scriptures in going along with the ceremonies. That's one way. That's a becoming. That's what I call becoming a Buddhist. But the actual Buddhist teachings is not. Buddha didn't teach Buddhism, but he taught Dharma, or he was pointing to the way things are, which is contemplative practice. And he pointed to the fact that all conditions are impermanent. And this is to contemplate impermanence, not to grasp the idea. And because you're a Buddhist now, you're going to believe in impermanence. But if impermanence or anicca is a contemplation. In other words, you concentrate your attention on this. You start looking at things in terms of change, rather than in maybe in terms of whether you like it or don't like it, or whether it's right or wrong or whatever. You're kind of changing your getting out of just the emotional reaction to looking at the characteristic. You're contemplating this state we're in, where we're born, we get old, we die. We're contemplating the movement of thought and emotion, mental states that where we get high, we get low, we're happy, we're depressed, we're interested and we're bored. We're contemplating the nature of just memory and of sound, of smell, sight. We're contemplating, meaning we're noticing, we're considering what these experiences that we have all the time. But we're contemplating them, that they're teaching of impermanence. Not to try to prove anything or make any moral judgment or value judgment about them, but to just notice, and to begin to notice how things that arise cease. So you're contemplating how one thing conditions another. If something doesn't arise, it doesn't cease, obviously. The arising conditions, say, what is that in human experience? What is modern life about in so much of the emphasis on just modern materialism? Say, consumerist society. Modern day Britain, what is the emphasis made? What do they advertise? What are the values that are common to, say, this present age, say, materialist, consumerist, modern, technological age? Is it something that is, the arising or the cessation of things? When you advertise something, and you want, say, if you're going to make a cinema film, and you want to get people interested in it, so that they'll spend their money, they'll go to the cinema and pay the entrance fee, and you certainly aren't going to draw crowds to something about cessation or emptiness. Of silence. Isn't it? You draw the crowds by promising them excitement. A thrill a minute. How many people get murdered? And how horrible? How much blood? How much how much romance? Romance is exciting. Sex is exciting. If it's full of sex, that excites the mind. And so notice that the modern tendency to try to, the mass media emphasizing, give us a lot of excitement to because that's the arising experience of life is that way. When you're interested in something, what is that? Because you can't stay interested in something. You get interested and then the interest wanes. You can become interested again, but to sustain an interest, what is your attention span? How long can you hold your attention on something? And then when it when it and if it starts getting boring, then what do? Contemplate this. You know what happens when you're feeling bored or tired or fed up or despairing, depressed. Oh, this is a contemplation, isn't it? We're looking at in our own life. Just what is it that we all experience these? We all can get excited and become interested, fascinated, inspired, high as a kite. But we can't sustain it for very long. And so you can see modern. We don't watch television. I very seldom ever get to see it. But just from the experience of the rare times that I do see this phenomena, it seems like it's the emphasis is on trying to entertain, interest, and excite people. So when we become aware of that, there's nothing wrong with that. We're not saying that it shouldn't be that way, but we're noticing that excitement or the arising side of life, the youth. We just had this family camp, and children, youth, all these are interesting. Children are interesting. When people bring me their babies are beautiful. Aren't they? They're always so beautiful to look at. So everybody that comes, I say, they show me their baby and say, "It's the most beautiful baby in the whole world." Some people think I'd be a good politician. But this is a reflection. It's not just flattery, is it? Because at that moment, that's the way it seems. At least as far as I'm concerned, that's the one thing I'm looking at right now, and it seems to be the most beautiful baby in the whole world at that moment. I'm not saying it is the most beautiful baby ever in the whole world. There's no baby more beautiful than that. But this is more of a reflection. And also, you can see that that's the way the mother feels. Because that's a natural feeling. When there's love and attention and so, then one feels like that. Then as you get on towards my age and older, people don't say that anymore. Because this is the other side. So the arising, say, that they were contemplating impermanence is we began to, say, emphasize, in the Buddha's teaching, emphasize the cessation of things. Because this is not generally noticed. Except by contemplative people. People that watch and listen to life and learn from it. Then we're interested in the other side. We've experienced maybe enough of the romance, adventure, and excitement of the arising stages of our lives and mental, emotional experiences that are that way. But we also recognize, we get a weariness of it. We feel, just to keep trying to be interested in things or have romantic affairs or have excitement and all that, we become bored with excitement. Or the idea of just having, one wonderful experience after another, it loses its attraction. We become more reflective and wondering what is, this experience of life now is what. Or, say, in meditation, we have to work through boredom. and despair. Because when we meditate, we have to deal with a lot of failure and despair, because we can't make ourselves successful at meditation. Even the most marvelously successful worldly people fail at meditation. So we contemplate that. If you're a success at meditation, there's something wrong with you. Because that's not the point. Not the point of becoming someone who can do it as a person, but it's being able to learn how to reflect on this and to be able to look at, say, things like despair, how rather than just wipe it out because you don't like it or get high on some kind of meditative technique. That's not what we regard as right meditation would be our ability to sustain attention on feelings that we usually don't bother with, or we can dismiss, or we tend to distract ourselves immediately from them. But in meditation, we're willing to be with them, with boredom, with despair, with disappointment, with confusion. And that means that then we can, contemplate it. It's like this. It feels this way. And strangely enough, when we appreciate this, it's a kind of wonderful relief that we don't have to spend our lives just trying to be happy and run around seeking exciting experiences and happiness in the sense world, but we can let go of that kind of compulsion. And we find a sense of relief and inner peace with just the conscious, being aware in the present. Pure presence. I read this translation of a Mahayana mantra, which is pure presence is transcending. So pure presence, just the ability to be in the present, is transcending, meaning that when we recognize that, when we realize that, then life is no longer a rat race. We're not running around in the cycles of samsara, because we find our joy in just being with this experience of life through this form, the way it is, this being here, and what happens to it. Whatever happens to it. And that is a relief. And sometimes they would describe Nibbana, the experience of Nibbana, as a relief. Where I remember when I was younger, I was thought of Nibbana as a kind of high. When you reach Nibbana, you're like floating up in the clouds. It's, you know, you're really... is ecstasy, and like a drug trip or something, you know. Nirvana is like the best. And then I read somebody's description of Nirvana as feeling a sense of relief. Not so inspiring. But when you contemplate that, contemplate this, the relief, like if something's really, you know, you feel wearisome, you've been walking too much and you're tired and exhausted and you sit down, that sense of relief, what is that like? You contemplate that feeling. And that's more and more the way you feel when you're meditating, a sense of relief. Not that you're... Because you're kind of letting go of this compulsive need to always be doing something, getting something, trying to control, trying to hold on, trying to get rid of bad things, and always this tension of strife and struggle, friction, And you stop doing it. You just, relief. Now that doesn't mean that every time you feel relieved you've realized Nibbana and you're an arahant. But it is a metaphor, isn't it, for that. I mean, it's something to contemplate. Because relief may be, even though at the moment we appreciate it, sometimes we don't appreciate it really. That feeling of relief, because we think it's just ordinary thing and it's of no significance. It's just, you know, I got tired and I sat down and felt of such a sense of relief. It's just me. And so we can dismiss things that we do, that we experience, because we see ourselves only in terms maybe in a very superficial way, or we don't appreciate the significance of our own conscious experience. But in meditation we're actually learning from things that are very ordinary, from the ordinary experience of life, that is not extreme, not unique in its sense that you have to struggle to get it. But people that can feel that can relax and let go of the world, one can understand the idea of it, but to actually be able to apply that, to be able to relate to life in that way, when we've all been kind of conditioned and programmed to strive and struggle, to distract ourselves, to always think we've got to do something, we've got to prove something, we've got to get something we don't have. We've got to get rid of all kinds of bad habits and tendencies that we have that we shouldn't. This kind of feeling, you can contemplate that very feeling. I've done that a lot. Contemplated this sense of I've got to do something. Because that is something that seemed to be very powerful and was always making my life as a monk, as a layperson, and as a monk, something that was always taking me to some kind of sense of despair. This sense of I've got to do it, I've got to meditate, I've got to attain something. And then you'd have certain immature emotional reactions, or you get angry, or you feel lust, or you'd feel uncertain or anxious or frightened by something, then you think, oh, I've got to get rid of this, these bad things. And we talk, even the way we talk, even in the Buddhist world, we talk about getting rid of the obstructions. Oftentimes they call about killing your kilesas. Kilesas are a Pali word for defilements. Sometimes you have this heavy talk, killing your defilements, killing your kilesas. And then the mind would go, I've got to kill these kilesas. And you almost end up killing yourself. Because that's very much how we tend to, it's easy for us to think and to see even meditation as another challenge to me personally, to me as a person. I've got to, I'm a person with a lot of faults. I've got to do something about this in order to become this enlightened person at the end of my life, or maybe in the next one. But notice in the contemplation of anicca or change, impermanence, we aren't looking at the whole span of life in terms of we have to do this. I mean, we do it. We learn how to contemplate our lives as it changes and we get old. But the insights come through very small things, like this scene, the despair, and being able to contemplate despair, anguish, grief, these kind of negative mental states, or anger, or uncertainty, anxiety, kind of nebulous, amorphous feelings, negative feelings that hang around us. We can contemplate them, meaning we acknowledge them, we begin to accept them for what they are, and observe them, be with them, sustain our attention on them. And what happens then? When we learn to do that more and more, that takes patience. We need to develop that sense of willingness and being patient. And patience means that we learn from our failures, and we have to keep off going back to square one and start again. But we develop patience, and then we have the insight into the end of suffering. That despair, when it's fully understood, when we accept it, and that is impermanent. It ceases, and when we let it go and it ceases, then there's this sense of relief. You feel this sense of, oh, this is nice. It's not like a high, but it's a sense of relief. And so we note that sense of relief, and in that, and this is my own reflections on relief, is that it's very peaceful, and in that state, there's no sense of yourself as being somebody, or having to become, having to prove, having to change, having to get rid of things, having to do anything. Nor is there a feeling that you don't have to do anything, because I don't have to do anything is just the same problem. But it's where you have let go of a condition that before you've never let go of. You've only distracted yourself from it, or repressed it in some way. And therefore, you've never known the relief from it. You only know how to just kind of, when this happens, you go like this and run away from it, or distract yourself, look in the other direction. But with meditation, with this contemplative meditation, then you actually recognize the whole cycle. This is the way it is, and the relief from grasping is like this. It's just this much. It's not anything you can describe in detail. But when you have that sense of relief, no, contemplate that. Begin to notice it more, rather than just dismiss it because it might not be of great significance to the universe at this moment. But it is something to contemplate. And in your own, say, practice of meditation, more and more you begin to get the feeling for it, of how, because just the idea of having to meditate often creates tension. It's interesting in monastic life how you just the idea of discipline. Say in monasteries, you've got discipline. The idea of discipline can create this how that affects the mind of many men and women. You've got to keep the rules. Now, what is that? I mean, just saying something like that. If you become a monk, you've got to keep 227 rules. That's why you wonder anyone would become a monk. But those are like when we talk like that, it's just say the idea of rules and discipline means that I've got to do this. I've got to keep all these rules. I've got to purify myself by keeping all these rules, maybe I won't be able to. And then the whole sense of oneself arises with an emotional reaction. This idea of discipline, rules, that are imposed on you. You've got to keep these rules. So I used to contemplate, is this what the Buddha actually intended his monastic system to be? You know, because this is oftentimes how it sounds to us. How we tend to, like my cultural background, being American, is a cultural background based on freedom, individual freedom, rights to be able to do what you want, be happy, and no hierarchical structures. We're all equal. President Clinton, Queen Elizabeth, me, we're all the same. So then there's a certain cultural pattern there that influences. And so, but you can contemplate this and say, so then I began to see if the Buddha if it's a wisdom teaching, and he's teaching us the way to non-suffering, to ultimate realization, then maybe how I interpret words like discipline, rules, and all that, maybe he didn't mean it the way I'm picking it up, the way I tend to react to those words. So then you contemplate, how can I apply these rules and this discipline so that it's not just an oppressive system that's reinforcing my ego or making me feel oppressed by having to live within these restraints. But it's obviously to change one's attitude. I could change my attitude towards it. I could just not bother to ordain, or I could leave the monastery and get out of the whole thing anyway. Nobody comes. Me to stay in, but maybe I've got it wrong just by my cultural reactions, my personal reactions to things like discipline, to rules, to hierarchy. So then this is where say somebody like Ajahn Chah's genius was I think very helpful to many Western monks, because he presented this very reflective teaching. And one began to see that if the actual monastic system was organized in a way so that you want to live it, and that you want to live your whole life within this style, well then, if it's just an oppressive system of rules that you've got to keep and you're frightened of breaking them and all that, then it becomes unbearable. You don't want to stay a monk very long if that's how you're living the life. You can only do that, operate like that for so long, and then you don't want to do it. It's just something that you can't stand. It just oppresses your mind. It makes you tense all the time. You're always worried. So then we think that we contemplate, well then, how do we live this life in which these tensions are relieved? By throwing out the rules and the discipline, that's not it. But in changing one's attitude through reflecting and contemplating. And learning how to relax or to be relieved by the no longer to create tensions around the conditions of the body, of the system that one is in. And of course that is using wisdom. The mindfulness, wisdom, sati, panya are the kind of important words in the Buddhist teaching. Mindfulness is the path to the deathless. Heedlessness is the way to death. Those who are mindful, those who are heedless, are always dying. This is from the Dhammapada. Those who are heedless, not mindful, just caught up into reacting to life heedlessly, they're like forever dying. Every moment there's some kind of death. So this means that death is like that. I mean, it's just always a sense of having to seek something new. You know, always having to be reborn again. Distracting yourself, moving from this to that. Just creature of habit. Just bound by the conditioning process. Not a free person to, not a joyful life, but just a creature that's just kind of learned how to react to this stimulation and that thing. So a heedless person is someone that's like always dying. There's always this sense of dying going on, as discomfort, ill at ease, distracted. He's like always dying. But those who are mindful never die. Oh, that's for contemplation. Now, recognized language is all slightly confusing because it is a limited tool. You know, you can't. Language only kind of points at things. It's not the realization. So, and sometimes you have to deal with paradox and. Because the limitation of language, you can only have one word at one moment. And so, you know, it's kind of linear process. So you have to have the noun and then the verb and the adjective and things like this, and kind of grammatical patterns that are considered good English. But so language is, you know, it's a tool. It's not something to grasp in itself, but it's a very helpful tool to us, and it's something that the Buddha used in his teaching. He used language, and the Dhamma teachings, there that's language, but it's a skillful use of language, not for grasping, but for this contemplation. So you're looking, you're watching, you're learning from life, from the very center of conscious experience, which is you yourself. And whatever it is that's going on, you know, whether even if you have crazy thoughts or whatever, it's still your refuge isn't in trying to get rid of it, but in understanding the conditioned realm is impermanent. And to feel the relief of that, to recognize the relief of letting go and non-attachment. And sometimes you just feel this a sense of relief in like, I remember in the mornings here, at 5 in the morning we meet in this hall and we sit till 6:30. And I really, I'm a morning person. I like the mornings, and so this is this sense of the community, the monks together here meditating. It's nice to be with other people, and then you're contemplating the state of mind you're in, the particular, you know, physical. Conditions that you're experiencing, and the kind of mood or the kind of thoughts that keep coming up, and you learn how to just accept all this and kind of embrace it and be with it, and then it all seems to kind of you're letting it go, and that sense of relief is a very you say. Nibbana is the highest happiness. There we go into superlatives. The Buddha said Nibbana is the highest happiness. That's a superlative. But what is the highest happiness? Not a drug trip into the Brahma realms, but the human, most ordinary kind of human experience of relief. So don't underestimate this, your own experience of life, and think that you have to get something that you've never had before, and that you've got to, and it's really hard and very difficult, and it's so, you've got to develop so many marvelous things in order to get it, that you don't see how you can possibly do it in this lifetime. That's the highest happiness in terms of conditioned highs. People have tried that, and there's drug culture, isn't it, that's happened in the last 30 years. It's pushing human pleasure to its heights, isn't it? Trying to get as much pleasure out of the sense realm, the emotional realm, as you can possibly squeeze out of your human state. And it can't maintain it. I guess I've taking some of these drugs, you must get in pretty kind of fantastic states of bliss or happiness or something or other. Because they certainly get addicted. That means they want to do it over and over again. But it's not sustainable, is it? You can't hold it with normal conscious experience. There is normal again, with ordinary conscious experience. So notice that meditation is not around taking drugs and special electronic equipment to get you into some kind of special state, but it's learning to be with learning to let go while sitting, standing, walking, lying down, while breathing. And so then the highest happiness isn't a condition of that depends on chemicals or equipment or special situations, but more and more we realize that that's the norm, the normal way. One can say Nibbana is the norm, but not Nibbana that we interpret as a far out high experience, but it's the balance where the self-importance, the grasping, the compulsion, the obsessiveness of our minds, we've let it all go for that moment. And that sense of relief, contemplate and notice that what it is like. And we like to go on some of these hikes. Remember, a year ago I went with Ajahn Sujito and a layman to the Pyrenees for 2 weeks. We hiked in the Pyrenees. After a long day's hike with sore feet and everything, and you sit down, and Nick would make a cup of tea. Nibbana. Relief, isn't it? Or that's a special situation, hiking in the Pyrenees for me, but in daily life at Amravati, how much just learning to recognize that state and trusting in it more and more, rather than thinking in the worldly mind is conditioned to make problems. So-and-so wants to disrobe, somebody's spreading some bad rumors, or this is how it happened, or all these kind of things that happen in the worldly life. There's so many kind of things to worry or feel anxious or feel indignant about in the worldly life, even in monastic life. If you're going to make that your refuge, then it's suffering to have no relief from it. But we can bear with these vicissitudes, with these conditions that are part of our human experience when we know the way of non-suffering. And so this I want to offer as a contemplation for you to consider this and to begin to get to know that within you. within your own experience of life. It's not something alien or foreign. It's just something you haven't noticed very much. or you've never really appreciated it because you tend to see yourself as somebody whose experience of life maybe you don't appreciate. You tend to compare yourself with somebody else or see yourself only in terms of critical ways. So we tend to disparage, easily disparage, and put ourselves down and not recognize the kind of marvelous things that are actually happening to us that we don't notice because we're so caught up in the conditions of our own that we regard as ourself. So I talk now for over an hour, so this time for a break, so the tea will be served, and in about 15 minutes I'll ring the bell and we can all sit down again and we can have a discussion. So, if there are any, I will attempt to answer them, discuss them, talk around them, refuse to answer them. So if you don't say anything, then they assume you're guilty. I think silence is very disturbing in those kind of situations where you're trying to, you want a reaction of that, you know, and silence is something that people don't appreciate unless you're is where you meet somebody and then they don't quite know what to say, and then there's a kind of embarrassed silence, and then you try to struggle to say anything. Sometimes you say some really silly thing because to fill that silence with something. But in they say in meditation you're cultivating silence. I like to, what I call, listen to silence, and you are kind of constantly kind of trying to think everything, or your mind is always so busy. It's in the silence that you can really relax, be, and with a good friend, isn't it? When you trust, then there can be silence. When you don't know somebody very well, then a silence. If you're trying to accuse somebody of something, then that's a good one to contemplate. Well, let's see, then that gives you the perspective. Like it's the suffering that is the key to non-suffering. It's like the first noble truth is the first truth is a truth of suffering. So it's pointing to a common experience that we none of us want suffering, but it's through that tension is that by contemplating that the tension or stress that you begin to realize the relief of it. Where if you don't contemplate it, you don't see it or accept it, then you tend to merely just create more stress. But even by trying to get out of it, you're still caught up in some struggle and suppression or repressive habits. And recognize that this realm is like the realm of a human realm, having a body. It is. It's a, tension in it. Just it's a natural part of it. Having to carry burdens or having to just survive it means that we have to work hard. We have to do all kinds of things to survive on this planet. But there's nothing wrong with that, or that, like we shouldn't feel this stress or tension. But if we aren't reflective, we don't contemplate, then we're merely caught up in the things that take us to, breakdowns, to bad health, to all kind of just depressions or kinds of miserable. We make our lives miserable. But when we put it in a context of noticing tension and relief, and that, then you have perspective on tensions and stress and suffering, and how to interpret it rather than in a personal way. Like what is really painful in modern human beings? We everything's personalized. It's always me. Everything is whatever mood or emotion, my anger, my lust, my problem. Everything is given such a it's seen in such personal terms, where a lot of these things are just part of the human experience. The suffering of life is common to us all. Sexual drives, all these are common to us all. These are not personal things. Hunger for food and things like because you can idolize, like I've seen monks do that. They think, I'm a terribly greedy person because I feel hunger for food. I mean, hunger for food isn't personal. That's a physiological thing. But yet we can feel that because we feel hungry for food that we're greedy. I mean, we can interpret it in that way. I've seen monks in Thailand, some of the Western monks used to just go on fast, to try to get rid of this greed for food. Lungpa Cho used to laugh at them all the time. Trying to get rid of something.